Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. Happy new fiscal year today, October 1st, 2012. And I wouldn't have known that if it hadn't been for Mike and Tammy. Mike who? Mike Causey. Mike is joining us this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And, you know, you can tell we both grew up in the Washington area if we celebrate fiscal year. That's pretty sad, isn't it?
Well, Tammy didn't, so she's got better sense, right? So good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
All righty. So we got a round table talking about current events. And I guess the one current event I didn't know, but the president signed into effect today, pay freeze for another fiscal year?
Yeah, it's confusing because we've known it was coming for some time, and the House did it, and then the Senate did it, but there was a delay in the president signing it. So it's been in the works, and we all knew it was going to happen. But I think most people assumed it had already happened, but indeed it was what, last week?
It was last week, but I wouldn't have known about it if it hadn't been for the good folks at Federal News Radio to tell me about it. Andrew.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew. Andrew's our engineer and knower of all things. It just happened. And so I guess it's another year. In class, I often hear, well, we didn't get a pay raise. And I feel for them. It's not that I don't. But some people don't have pay to get a raise.
They're 50 shades of gray here, if you will, in this Ooh. In this painting. And one of them is a lot of people have had their pay frozen since the recession started. And I personally know five people who took pay cuts ranging from 5% to 25%. One of them lasted 2 years, another lasted 3 years. So that's a freeze is bad, of course, but a cut is worse. And as you pointed out, not having a job is even worse than that.
Yeah, it's.
But the thing of it is, too, that for younger employees or newer employees who are just starting out their careers, they can still get promotions. They can still get step increases. So there's not the fact that everybody's pay is frozen across the board. It's those annual pay adjustments that are frozen. So if you're coming into federal service and you're just starting out and you want to work your way up the career ladder, that's still possible to do.
Well, and that's a good point. And the Federal Times not long ago did a study. And they actually looked at the numbers, and it was something between a third and a half of the federal workforce got a 3% pay raise within a 1 or 2 year period. And that was either step increases or promotions, which are still happening in a lot of federal agencies. And when you mention that 3% raise, people will write in and say it's not 3%, it's 3.2 at the beginning, but at the end it's only 2.8 or something like that. But it's nearly 3%, and you know it's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
And sure. The other thing too, for employees near retirement, they're the ones who are suffering the most from the pay freeze because they're not getting promotions or step increases. Many of them are topped out, as we call it, at the top of their pay grade. So they're the only thing that really affects their salary is those annual pay adjustments.
Right. And if you're a GS-15 at the top of the step, it's a good place to be. But it's still those people have been frozen, some of them for years before the freeze.
Okay. So we talked about that, but kind of a spinoff to that is this discussion potentially of high five versus high three. Tammy wrote an article, very good, did a side-by-side comparison, what, about a year and a half ago?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
And so if we have a pay freeze, the high five and the high three really don't make any difference, do they? Unless, like you say, they got a step increase or a merit increase.
Well, the last basic pay adjustment was in 2010. So if in fact Congress did switch to a high five calculation, if they changed the law to require that, then employees would have to go back if they were going to retire, let's say the end of 2013, you'd go back to 2008. So there have been a couple of pay adjustments since then, which would cause your high five calculation to be less than your current salary. Whereas with the pay freeze that's ongoing right now, a high three calculation for many retiring employees is looking a lot like a high one because it's the same as what they're currently making. So I know that employees would not welcome, they would not be happy about a high five, but the actual difference in their retirement benefit would not be huge. It would be noticeable, but it wouldn't be huge. But in reality, I'm not sure that that would even happen. I mean, I know it's a proposal. I know it's on the slate of Congress, but it's not definitely not a done deal.
Well, I know we've talked about it in the past many, many times over the years. And this last 2 years, it's been the number one focus, not of we, quote, experts, but of people, you know, the rank and file people in the field. This is the most ask question. What are they going to get the high five? Are they going to impose this? Are they going to do that? And in fact, it's always been low on the totem pole, low in the under the radar for most politicians. It saves a minimum amount of money for the government, and it would cost federal workers a minimum amount of money, and they could work a few. In some cases, they could work a few months longer, and make up for any loss under the high three to high five.
So there are ways around it.
Keep working. Keep working. You know,
that's right. You work a couple of months longer, and you'll have outdone the high five. Yeah, because having more service, because as most employees know, maybe not, but I know a lot of employees know that their retirement calculation for either CSRS or FERS is based on your salary and your service. So the more service you have, the higher percentage of your salary you get. So every month of service increases that percentage, which, as Mike just said, you know, can eliminate the problem of having a high five just by having sometimes just a few more months of service, depending on the difference in your pay today versus 3 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, I know at the beginning of this year and even middle of last year, a lot of people were saying, do I have time to retire? Can I get out before they switch to the high three and the high five? And we consistently told them, and Tammy told them, that this has been around since the 1980s.
Right.
And, you know, it's been around every year. It's been the horror show coming in, and it hasn't happened. And if it did happen, it's a minimal impact.
True. And the longer they stay on the job, the more money they can put into their thrift. And the assumption, too, is the more disposable income they'd have on the job than what they would in retirement. But that thrift is just... everybody beats on the thrift is great because it is great. And here's an opportunity to then defer the higher salary that they've been used to. And they can also do the term front loading. When mm-hmm. I say that in class, to people, what's a front loading? Well, long story short, what that is, an individual normally, because of the dollar magnitude that can go into the thrift, they can't afford to do it all at once. So they spread it out over 26 pay period cycle if they were there the entire year. But if they're not going to be there the entire year, like you say, 6 more months on the job, they can still put the same full $17,000 or $22,500, depending on age, into the thrift by putting it in up front. It causes a restriction of cash flow.
Yeah.
But what I tell people in class is they could cut back on their withholding taxes. It's kind of crazy to have withholding taxes on money that's not going to be taxable. And this would free up the cash flow for them if they were trying to do it in a shorter period. 3 months would be very hard to do. 6 months is easier to do, but not easy. 9 months is better, but anyway, so that's a comment on that. And when we were in the green room, Tammy had a whole list of proposed bills or legislation that's, is it moving at glacier speed or is it moving faster than that?
I don't think nothing's going to move between now and election day because, you know, some of these proposals could end up losing votes for, I guess, some of the constituents because they would be negative impact on federal employees. And some of them, I guess, that negative impact on federal employees would make other constituents vote for the congressman. So I think they're just going to stay away from some of this, I would imagine, until after the election. And some of it will just not move. For instance, there's been a proposal to get rid of the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset, I think, Mike, since those bills were enacted.
Yeah.
And so those bills are still pending in Congress after, you know, in some cases over 20 years. Just different variations of the same thing. So there's a lot of things that Congress will propose to change. They're not getting the support they need from the rest of Congress to make those changes. And I did a little study a few weeks ago just to look back over the last 30 years of how many negative laws were passed that would really negatively impact federal employees. And what I found surprisingly, I think this surprises a lot of employees, is that a lot of those changes were actually improvements. You know, a lot of the laws that actually get enacted can actually improve a federal employee's retirement benefit. You know, for instance, for FERS employees, they used to lose their sick leave when they would retire. It would just evaporate. But under 2009 legislation, sick leave now counts for FERS employees when they retire. So there's some incentive there to keep it and save it. And when you retire, at least it'll count for something. For CSRS employees, they have had the change in part-time calculations for employees who want to kind of ease into retirement. They can have that part-time service still count as full-time in their high three. So that doesn't penalize them for working part-time at the end of their career. And that's another 2009 change. And then for all employees, this summer was the phased retirement bill that signed into law in July. And OPM doesn't have a timeline yet, but that should be implemented, I would think, sometime in 2013, once OPM has had a chance to really review the legislation, see what the intent of the law was, and create a way for agencies to implement that law. So I don't really, everyone says I'm Pollyanna, but I don't really think it's, the sky is falling, as a lot of employees seem to think. I think it's more that Congress is on the same team as we are, and they try to, make things fair and equitable. Boy, now I'm really going to have people call in.
I agree with you. Mm-hmm. If that's Pollyanna, so be it. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people don't like to look at this historically, but from the 1960s through the 80s, it was nothing but go, go, go. Everything in the federal government improved. The retirement system was improved. The formula was changed to the high three. Pay was improved dramatically. Wage grades, things were improved. Even under President Nixon, some people say that President Nixon was the best president that federal workers ever had because of some of the changes that were made when he was president. Things started tightening up dramatically, but nothing really bad happened. They didn't take a step backwards. And then, as Tammy said, 2009 is arguably the best year federal workers have ever had. Six or seven things came together that had been pending for years. They came together and became legislation or became law. And then the next year, 2010, we start with a pay freeze. So this can turn on a dime.
Okay, let me go back. The first sentence, the high three was a better deal than what it was before. Was it the high five?
It was high five before, yeah.
Before 1970, I think it
was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so that was one of those changes in the 60s and 70s. That was one of those changes that was made. And it was a kind of a minor bookkeeping thing, I think, to benefit a particular member of Congress. And
I can't believe that.
If I thought he was dead, I would tell you who it was. But he was a congressman from Michigan. He was on the House Post Office Civil Service Committee, and he was having marital difficulties, which is, multiple ex-wives. And they did this to boost his annuity and kick one of the wives out of a business. If you can imagine that happening on the Hill.
Listen, if you want to hear all these little known facts, we're here and we're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And there's probably not a question you can ask that we wouldn't at least be able to provide some light on it, if not answer it square on. And that includes benefits, rumblings in Congress, crazy cousin rules. That's the tax side of me. Uh-huh. And tax or finance. So please give us a call.
Well, I knew you were a tax guy when you said restriction of cash flow. Now, I would say not eating.
Nope. Well, we've been told to be diplomatic over the years. You can't be so frank with people. Okay.
Yeah.
But I'm an accountant. I don't know how to not be.
I think another thing that's kind of on the horizon that a lot of FERS employees are worried about is the elimination of the FERS supplement. And that's something else that I think may have some meat, probably as much meat as the high five change might have, that, that could happen. Perhaps. And I was looking into seeing how many employees are really affected by that. How many retiring FERS employees are there? And then how many retiring FERS employees actually get the FERS supplement? And I guess to explain what that is, the FERS supplement is a kind of a bridge payment. It's a temporary payment that's added to the FERS retirement benefit for employees who retire younger than 62 years old, because once you are 62, you can apply for Social Security. So it's for employees who retire younger than 62 who are eligible for an immediate unreduced FERS benefit. So out of the 38,000 some FERS retirements in 2011, there were about 18,000 of those employees who were not eligible for the supplement. So it ends up being slightly more than half of the FERS employees don't get a supplement anyway. So the other 19,000 or so employees who do receive the supplement It's a temporary payment. It adds, on average, about $40 a month for every year that they have under FERS. So if you have an employee with 20 years under FERS who's retiring at age 60, for instance, that might be an $800 a month added benefit to their FERS annuity, at least until they turn 62. And for a 30-year employee, maybe around $1,200 a month. So that is something that Congress has looked at to possibly eliminate for everybody except those subject to mandatory separation, such as firefighters and law enforcement. So that's another thing I think that's been on the minds of a lot of employees as far as worrying about any changes to their retirement right before they leave. You know, that's right up there with a high three to high five change. But again, I think probably the more savings that Congress would gain would not be by either one of those. It would be from just eliminating the FERS benefit altogether, which might happen some point down the road in the future, but I don't think it's anything they have to worry about for next year.
Yeah, that's the really scary one, that and Tammy brought it up. You know, these other things are formula changes or even the slight reduction in future inflation adjustments or what have you. But what she's talking about here is simply eliminating the pension portion of the government package. So you'd have Social Security and you would have the 401k plan, the thrift savings plan, like people in the private sector do, but there would be no government retirement plan as such. And I think that's so frightening to people that they don't think about it.
I'm hearing an echo in my earphones. Mm-hmm. I think it's people throwing books at the radio speaker. But after hearing that.
Yeah, well, but I don't think it's a big worry, because I don't think it would affect anybody currently working for the government. I think if Congress made a change like that, it would be for those people first being hired after whatever date that law were to pass. So I think that would be a win-win for federal employees, because the current workforce wouldn't have to worry. And Congress would say, we're going to save a ton of money because we're just not going to have a pension plan into the future. And then for new employees getting hired, what do they have to decide between?
That's right. The government or another a private company that also doesn't offer a pension.
Or a long-term employment.
Or long-term employment.
And I shouldn't have said that. I'm going to get in trouble. Yeah. Tammy, I got to ask you a question. Huh. Now, this is, we got the FERS supplement that will phase out at 60 or leave at 62. Social Security kicks in. If that person is working and making more than X, they're not going to get any Social Security anyway. But, of course, they have this other income.
Right. The supplement that I mentioned, as well as Social Security itself, are both subject to an earnings limit, at least with Social Security, until you reach the full retirement age, which is somewhere around 66 or 67 for current employees. So for many employees, when they retire at a younger age, maybe at age 50 under an early out, or 56 or 57, even under regular retirement, many employees are still young enough, healthy enough, they don't want to stop working altogether. So many will start a second career. And if that second career allows you to earn a nice income, then that income can cause a reduction and sometimes an elimination of the supplement. And if you are 62, an elimination of your Social Security. So for 2012, this year, the earnings limit, the amount you can earn and still receive that supplement or still receive Social Security, is $14,640. And that's not per month, that's per year. So basically, if you're doing much more than greeting at Walmart or working weekends at Home Depot, you may lose some of that supplement, if not all of it. Because for every $2 you earn above the $14,640, you're going to lose a dollar of that benefit. So therefore, it's not unlikely that some retirees, even though they're entitled to the supplement, they may not actually get it because they go back to work.
This is, I would say, interesting to people that would be otherwise unknowing of it. Have you written an article on that?
On the supplement?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've written a couple of them. They've been a few years old, but if you go to my index of articles, you can find the supplemental. I think I call it supplemental annuity for FERS. But, yeah, so it's a nice benefit if you're going to fully retire. But if you're not going to be fully retired, then chances are you're not going to get it anyway, or you're going to get a very reduced vision of it.
I think folks would be of interest. I know you covered that in class, and I will probably cover it in class more now, because I do talk about the impact of Social Security, and if you are going to go to work, you needn't worry about getting it between 62 and whatever your normal retirement age is.
Right. It's almost that we could almost do a whole show on just the strategies of actually retiring for good versus, you know, partially retiring, or when to take Social Security benefits between 62 and 70, because that's almost becoming a science of itself. And I think the reason why so many people are trying to decide, you know, do I take it at 62? Do I wait till I'm 65 and a half? I think it's because we have the luxury to do that. In days gone by, in fact, for many people, even today, you don't have a choice. If you want to be retired, you have to take Social Security because it might represent half of your retirement income. But if you're fortunate that you have enough other income, whether it's from your government pension or your savings account, your investments, that you can have the luxury to postpone your Social Security, then it becomes a decision of financially which time's the best time to take
okay. it. Okay. You might remember this call. It was a few years ago. It was from me. And I was getting close to 62 at the time. And I said, Tammy, what if I elect to get Social Security? I won't get any because I work. But if they cut it out or something or they push the age back, am I then still going to be a grand person? Do you remember that call?
I do.
And you kind of laughed at me.
I do.
Very nice. So you were diplomatic.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing is, I think in history proves this, that when Congress does have to make changes, and they probably will again, to the Social Security programs, many times those changes are grandfathered in. You know, going back to the 1983 amendments that were the last real big amendments to Social Security, anybody who was born in 1937 or earlier wasn't affected. So that would have been the people who were turning 62 right then, the people who had already planned on getting that Social Security benefit in its present form as part of their retirement. So they didn't have to worry. And I remember even when President Obama gave the first State of the Union address that he gave, he said that if you were born in 1950 or earlier, then you wouldn't have to worry about any future changes to Social Security because you would be protected. And it's the same thing. It's grandfathering in any future changes to not negatively impact those people who are currently retiring. So I think I just keep hoping that Congress waits long enough that they'll say if you were born in 1958 or earlier, you don't have to worry because that'll be my year of birth.
Well, and you know, but by that example, it also shows they can promise something and then 10 years down the road, they can change it because they do make the laws.
That's right.
So one president can promise it, but if he's long gone or not running anymore, things could still change.
Okay. We got an email came in last night at, 10:40. Into For Your Benefit at NITPinc.com, which you all can do as well. And this is from our friend, I believe he's in California, and it looks like he changed the website. I'm not going to mention names, but a good question. Do you expect, and this was pretty much to Tammy, do you expect early outs to accelerate in 2013? And secondly, what issue is under the radar that could affect a federal employee negative next year? Well, we hit a number of those, but what do you think about the early outs?
Well, I think that's going to depend on this word that's been batted around a lot in the recent weeks called sequestration. And I guess another word for sequestration would be major budget cuts, or another phrase for that would be major budget cuts. So if those budget cuts come to light, if they really happen, if Congress doesn't do anything to prevent them, then I think some agencies may be kind of forced into offering early retirement to live within that reduced budget arena. So that would be the thing that would cause more early outs. I think if that doesn't happen, I think there are some agencies whose budgets, even under the current proposals, are being squeezed perhaps a little bit, that maybe you'll see some maybe targeted early outs. I don't know there'll be that many.
Mike, you hear any rumblings?
I don't hear any rumblings, but I think that's right. But there's a caveat there, and that is that people don't retire, and particularly they don't take early retirement when the economy is bad.
You know, right.
They hang on to their jobs. So if the agency comes along and says, we're going to let you retire at age 50 with 20-year service, or at any age after 25 years service, you'll get a reduced annuity, but you can go. And you look outside and you see people, the unemployment in the 8% or 9%, people tend to stick around, even with a buyout offer. They tend to stick around when the economy is bad. So I would answer it two ways. I'd say there probably will be an increase in early retirement offers next year, maybe with buyouts accompanying them, but I don't think the number of people taking them will be any higher.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, too, to note that the average age of a federal employee at retirement is what, do you think? I saw this number just the other day.
I thought it was 62.
Bob?
I'd say 58, but 58? I don't know.
Right in between the two, it's 60.9 or something. Like about 61 years old is the average age for both. And it's funny, it's almost the same for FERS and CSRS.
So, and that's seeing, lower than the in the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Tammy, would that average in law enforcement types that maybe would have to retire at an earlier age?
I think that number, in fact, I can look it up, but I think that number takes into account everybody. So I guess if you took out the people who have to retire early, it'd probably be a higher number.
Okay.
Be a higher number.
Because I just, I don't know why I said 58, because when I do the classes, I can look at them and tell they're not 58. Nor if I looked in the mirror, I would see the person's not 58. So there's nothing wrong with
mirrors
that.
Mirrors can be cruel.
Yes, they are. Anyway, Tammy, what else is on your radar tracking?
For next year?
Yeah.
For changes? I'm not sure that there's any other big things that are going to affect federal employees that we've heard of yet. I'm sure a new Congress will be coming in, and they'll have some of their own ideas about what they might want to change or adjust or tweak a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see. But like I said, a lot of the changes we've seen in the past have been improvements. And, you know, the TSP you mentioned before is one prime example of that, because this year we're still in the process of implementing the TSP changes that took effect in 2009. So the last of those changes was the Roth TSP. So that's now available. And along with that was spousal accounts for deceased TSP participants, where their spouse can now own their TSP account without having to make some major life decisions. So there were some nice changes, actually, to the TSP recently. And over that 25-year history of the TSP being in existence, we've seen it evolve into something that was very restrictive, I guess, it had to be initially, to something that's become a lot more liberalized and have more options for employees to invest and save for their retirement. So that's another example of where Congress has had to make changes to make things work, but also they improved things. And many of that was, I think, based on what employees wanted.
Well, you know, back to sequestration for a minute, because that's been the scary word du jour for a long time now. Nobody really knows how it would operate. The White House has put out some mixed signals. On the one hand, the president said it would be, I think he used the term, disastrous if it happened for the government. And yet the Labor Department has told companies they don't need to mail out warning letters to contractors, defense contractors, saying they might be laid off. They said it's too early for that. It's premature. Maybe they're right. Maybe they're having it both ways. But everybody that's looking at sequestration is focusing on the most negative parts of it. Contractor groups have said 200,000-300,000 contractors will be fired or furloughed or both if sequestration takes place. Others have estimated 150,000-100,000 federal workers will be fired or laid off, and that a larger number than that will be furloughed for as much as 20 days, you know, 5 days a week or 1 day per month or something like that. But there's another possibility to this that is not getting much interest yet, but it's out there, and that is that nothing's going to happen. The Congress can stop sequestration. You know, people thought the continuing resolution would stop it. It doesn't. But Congress could simply say, no, we're not going to do it. They invented this thing. I call it a Dr. Strangelove ticking time bomb thing. They invented this thing. They set it to go off January 3rd, but they could stop it at the last minute and kick it down the road. So while we have these worst-case scenarios, it's also possible that nothing will happen.
All righty. I, you know, live on the tax side of life and the finance side of life, and the tax laws are drastically going to change if nothing's done prior to January 1st. But I don't ever remember, and doing this a long time, where they let something like that happen. So I read in my trade rags, and they're discussing extending maybe some things, small things, and maybe changing some big things initially and then do an overhaul later on. Because it's very hard to write tax legislation and go retroactive back to January 1st if they don't make up their mind till March. I mean,
they've done it in the past.
It's really been
a nightmare. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I believe you mentioned one time, correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the categories, the 10%, would just go away.
Yeah.
Is that... And the others would change?
And what Mike is talking about, the tax structure is such that the first group of one's income, first amount of one's taxable income, is taxed at a 10% rate. Now, this is very small, but nonetheless, for somebody with a very low income, it's very attractive. That would be gone. These were Bush tax cuts. I'm not political. Mm-hmm. So these were pre-Bush tax cuts. That 10% wasn't there. It started at 15. So you would think that that would not happen. I don't know. And then, of course, there's the eye with the people that make more than X. They're really going to add to them, not only in tax rates, but they got this, they call it a Medicare income tax, and it's 3.8% additional tax on dividends, interest, capital gains. And please listen, when one sells a house, generally, most people don't pay taxes on the sale of their residence because the exclusion is so high. It's $500,000 in a joint situation and $250,000. There's just no tax. But if they're lucky enough to sell the house for more than that, they would be subject to capital gains, which is nice. But that gets the 3.8% added on top of it. And people call up and say, if I sell my house, I have to pay 3.8% of the... I said, no, it's only if you make a killing. And most people don't because of what's happened in the market. But, I mean, there's just a lot of things. People that maybe not a federal employee, but they might have a friend or a spouse that's a teacher. And it's a token deduction, but teachers oftentimes will take money out of their pocket to take the kids to, you know, McDonald's, I'll say, because there's no budget for it, or there's no budget for a certain type of crayon or presentation skill. And they'll let them claim a flat amount of $250. If they spend more than that, they get $250. That goes away. So there are things that would impact, I would say, people that need it. And for all this stuff just to disappear and go back, I've seen it, but it's hard to believe they'd let it happen. But they don't have a lot of time between the election and year's end, because IRS has got a program in estimated taxes and the like for the next year.
Remember a couple of years back, they made some major changes in the tax code, but it was late in the year, and the IRS sent out forms that turned out to be wrong.
They didn't have a choice. Yeah.
They were, of course, the Congress beat them up for doing it, but the Congress caused the problem, and then they had to come back and send out new forms, and I guess there's still reverberations from that.
I remember one year where they didn't get their act together till mid-year, and they had two different tax rates. They had half your income is taxed at one level before July 1st and another one after June 30th. I mean, picture doing the tax returns then.
Well, it looks like we might be heading for a year like that again when things might be changing as we move into that year when we start to file our returns.
And, you know, just to go to that, right now, year-end tax planning, I mean, most people do it, whether it's writing an early donation check, but there are people now in small businesses that would want to pay more tax in 2012 because they figure the tax rate's going to go up so much in 2013. Totally opposite of what most people do now. So there's just a lot of unknowns and things to do. Some elderly folks that would want to give their IRAs to a charity, it's a very nice thing, but they can do that now, but after the end of the year, they can still do it, but it can't go directly to the charity. So there's just so many tentacles to this tax law, and if they try to simplify it or they try to change it, there's a whole new learning curve, and somebody's going to say, well, yeah, that's good for you and your profession. Well, yeah, but you'd rather not make your money by doing that. You'd rather help people understand what's there rather than trying to help people understand it was there, but isn't there anymore.
Yeah. It changed.
Yeah.
Well, I got the statistics if you
okay.
want.
Okay,
right. So this was as of a year ago today, October 1st of 2011. And this was the employees who retired in the fiscal year 2011. You know, we don't have them from this year because they're probably just now being tabulated. So in fiscal year 2011, of the CSRS employees, which made up almost 45,000 of the total retirees in 2011, of the CSRS employees who retired under normal retirement, that's anywhere from 55 and above, just regular civil service retirements, of that group, the average retirement age was 60.7 years old. Is it 66.7? Yeah, again, get my eyes out. No, it's 60.7 years old.
See, I was going to say I'd figured that's young because they have an awful lot of incentive to stay a little bit longer to get another 2% added on to their.
Yeah, but many of them who retire at that time have a lot of service. You know, they've got, in fact, the service, here we go. The average mean years of service for those employees was 30.9 years. Okay, so that's the regular civil service. Now, of the special provisions, the law enforcement, air traffic controllers, members of Congress are in that group. Of that group, the average age was 55.8 years, which is still a little older than their earliest age because they can retire as young as age 50. So they're going out almost close to their mandatory age of 57. Now, of the FERS employees made up 37,839 retirees in fiscal year 2011. Of that group, the regular retirements, the normal retirements, with and without reduction, I guess it is, the average age was 63 and a half. So our FERS employees are retiring a little bit later, probably because they don't have as much service. You know, they were all hired after 1983. And of the law enforcement group in that bunch, the average age is slightly less, age 54. And the other interesting thing, that's this is all coming from statistical information. It comes out from OPM every year in May. These numbers get compiled and then they publish them. But the other interesting thing is that the current federal workforce is now 89% FERS. So it's like 10% civil service left and 90% FERS pretty much, which never thought I'd see that day when it was almost all FERS rather than CSRS. It didn't take that long, did it, Mike?
There was a guy at the Office of Personnel Management, and we were talking about this, and this is probably 15 years ago, but he predicted, he said, the last person retiring under the civil service retirement system, it will occur, and I forget what, I'll make up one, to 2022 or something like that, and it'll be a D.C. government employee, someone under the D.C. system. And he had some rationale behind this, which I can't recall right now. But it is interesting to think that he or she is out there walking around somewhere.
Yep.
When the FERS folks first started coming to the classes, I'm sure, Tammy, you remember, I'm sure you remember it from questions, Mike, there might be two or three in the class. And a lot of what was talked about, it wasn't applicable to them. And now it's almost the opposite.
Yeah, it is. And you have personnel offices. If you have them staffed by people who are under the old civil service retirement system, they may not be up on the new as of 1984 rules as other people.
Yeah, and I see in the classes, I see younger and younger people, I mean young people in late 20s, early 30s in the pre-retirement classes. And I asked them, one, that had you come in here, not that I control it, but I was more interested in why. And, you know, almost to the person is that we want to know now, because we've seen if you wait too long to know, you didn't make the right move before. So I want to know in my late 20s or early 30s, what am I looking for down the road? And I can adjust my spending habits, my lifestyle, so that I'll be better able to land the ship come retirement age.
Well, you know, that's interesting that agencies would allow that, would allow the younger people to come in. And I think it's smart that they let them come in.
So do I.
Because if you look at, you know, as a 20-year-old, you don't think about retirement. 30-year-old, you don't think about retirement, or maybe 4 minutes a year or something like that. But if they let you go to a class like yours in ITP, and you think, this is what I've got, and look at what your parents have and what your classmates have who don't work for the government, I would think that would be an incentive to stay.
I thought it was good, too. And a couple of them, they hadn't been there 6 months. And they'll come up at the break and they'll go, you know, what about this? Because a lot of my comments aren't designed to them, but I can answer them. And they're very smart to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, it's smart for the agencies to permit them to do it too. I think it's kind of a recruiting, or not a recruiting, but a retention tool.
You know, I think another thing that people coming from private industry into federal service, they have to understand this, is that our retirement benefits in the federal government are based on whims of Congress, because this retirement system is huge and it's part of the federal budget. So it's one of the earmarked trust funds, basically, along with Social Security and Medicare and government employees' health benefits. So I think that's one of the reasons why Congress always looks at this as a way to, if you look at the whole pie of the federal budget, this is a slice of it. And so if you can save money here, it's going to help the overall budget appearance, you know, from the outside looking in. So I think that's where employees coming into federal service, they're like, oh, well, why do we care about what Congress does? Well, because they can make changes to the law that affect your retirement, because it saves, if it saves money to the piece of pie, it saves money to the overall budget.
And the best thing that can happen to federal workers is to have their benefits linked to the Congress and vice versa. You know, as long as a member of Congress benefits from this, they may get a slightly better deal, a better formula, but it protects it.
But Congress is slowly pulling themselves away
exactly.
from that.
Yeah. Yes,
so they're
exactly.
pulling themselves out of the federal employees' health benefit plan. They've pulled themselves out of the liberalized provisions for them under civil service and FERS. So they've been voting to keep their constituents happy, I suppose, you know, to say that we're just like everybody else. You know, we have to save for our retirement. We have to use the same health insurance as other Americans use. So I think that little bit of oomph that we've had as federal employees have had is maybe going to disappear.
Yeah, the linkage is not so strong.
Yeah. But there was a study done, and I guess they do this periodically. The Congressional Research Service is always asked to do work, you know, to support different things that happen. And they've said that the Civil Service Trust Fund, which is where all the money going into civil service retirement, all the money going into FERS goes to support paying those benefits, is actually in very good shape. It's designed so it will pay out benefits for the next 75 years without running dry. And I think where people get confused is that it does have an unfunded liability, because the way civil service was set up, we didn't have to have the money in there to pay those future benefits. It was kind of pay as you go. Although that's changing with FERS, because the FERS system, the money does have to be funded in order to pay future benefits. So that funding system is changing. But regardless of how you look at it, it's still set up to pay benefits into the foreseeable future.
And Bob, I want to ask you something about unfunded liability. And as you know, I'm math challenged. But when my first son was born, I bought some cigars, went down to the Washington Post to pass them out to my friends. That was allowed in those days. They were cigars with blue bands. And I handed him to one of the older guys. He's probably 50, but he seemed ancient to me. And I handed him a cigar and said, I have a son. And he said, he pushed it back very dramatically. And he said, hang on to that. You're going to need it. A baby costs, and I think he said a baby at that point was going to cost me $200,000 but until age 18. That was my unfunded liability for having a child. Yeah. And I thought, well, I'm making $57.50 a week. I'm going to have to give this kid away. As it turned out, he has three brothers and sisters. So, and I made it to that. But an unfunded liability, it's not, again, the people who worry about everybody collecting the same day, right?
Right. But an unfunded liability, a perfect example is probably not Social Security or the retirement benefits. It's your savings.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't save, you have a liability coming when you do retire to make up the difference between your living expenses and what you do get in Social Security and or a pension. And so it's an unfunded liability that you're going to have. If you don't pay attention to that early, like you got the mm-hmm. good advice, then it's very hard to catch up later on. They have studies on, oh. well, if I don't really start doing this for another 5 years, it's big. It's dramatic if you put it off 10 years. It's very hard to catch up. And then you have other expenses at that time. The child is now older and said, I want the keys to the car and I want money for the gas and I want money to go to the, to have something to eat and go to the mm-hmm. movies. That's an unfunded liability, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I think the other thing that people get all hung up over is the idea of a trust fund. Like the Social Security Trust Fund needs to be kept sacred for Social Security, and the Civil Service Trust Fund needs to be kept sacred. But I was reading this report. It's very interesting to read about some of these congressional things in history of Congress and so forth. And it said, in the federal budget, the meaning of the term trust fund differs from its private sector usage. You know, in private industry, a person creates a private trust fund using your assets, you know, to benefit a stated individual. But in the government, in contrast to that, the federal government does not have a fiduciary responsibility to the trust fund beneficiaries, and it can raise or lower future trust fund collections and payments or change the purposes of which those collections are used by changing the laws. So we know that. And that's why on every Social Security statement, it says, this is your benefit under current law. Congress can mm-hmm. change this law at any time, and you know they have changed those laws in the past. So there's no contract by which we work, by which we are expecting to get those benefits. That's always subject to change.
Well, also, when they talk about a trust fund, you know, I think of the money is in a vault somewhere, mm-hmm. and it's marked, you know, Mike's Trust Fund B. But in fact, this is all commingled money, is it not? I mean,
they're just earmarked, and they use that term earmarked for Social Security, earmarked for civil service.
But it's not like Fort Knox, where they've got the gold, or the Federal Reserve in New York, where they've got the gold. It's all coming from one big pot.
Right, and that's where people worry about, like, the G fund being used to pay other bills. Like, if we didn't use the G fund to pay some of the government's bills, there'd be a lot of federal employees furloughed right about now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the law works that it puts that money back whole, including any interest that's due. So no one in their TSP account ever sees any money missing. You know, if I wanted to deplete my entire TSP account on any given day, I could do that without worrying about some of it having been out on loan to pay off, you know, other government bills. So I think that's always an area of confusion for a lot of employees when we hear about, you know, G fund money or civil service trust fund money or Social Security money being used for other purposes, and I think that's where the confusion
somebody
comes
in the
from.
Media discovers it every time it happens, and then they come out with this, and the numbers are right, except the system is wrong. So, and there's about 400 people in the TSB who chronically worry about losing this when the government has to raise its borrowing rate, and the G fund money is used, and it's suspended for a time being. But according to all of the experts, nobody loses a nickel.
And one of the earliest and largest trust fund was the Civil Service Trust Fund, 1920.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Predated Social Security by 15 years.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I mean, we all, I'm from the South.
Y'all.
And IRA is a trust fund. I mean, it isn't like a government trust fund. We've invested the money for some future purpose, and it's held in trust, if you will, until we decide to take it out. But that's either funded or it's not. And there's no, the feds can't borrow from it and the like. And there might be savings accounts, a trust fund. So it's set aside for some future date.
Yeah.
And these are all long-term investments, you know, whether it's an IRA or civil service trust fund or what have you. It's a commitment we're making not just for tomorrow, but for someone's lifetime.
By the way, I'd like to say something on the Roth TSP in class. I teach more the pre-retirement than I do the beginning or the mid-career. But in the pre-retirement, usually people don't want to hear about it because it's very tax inefficient at that point. But there are people in that pre-retirement class that have not been with the government long, and they might, well, take advantage of the Roth TSP because they maybe came from private industry or there's some other money somewhere else so that their tax bracket isn't necessarily as high as it's going to be, even in retirement. Sounds odd, but they shouldn't just turn it off because it doesn't do me any good at this stage of my life because my tax bracket is so high. Well, it might not be so high if you're, again, a recent entrant to the federal system.
So, but Roth, I mean, it's a young person's game by and large.
Greg Long was on the show, and I thought he nailed it. He called it the barbell effect. It's going to be very attractive to somebody younger because they're at the beginning of their earning period, so they can forego the tax benefit for tax-free growth for life.
Sure.
And then as you start to go up to the kind of the center of the barbell, then you start to scratch your head, your mid-career. Your income's a little higher. And then on the other side is the pre-retiree making more than they've ever made. And in order to put the same amount into the Roth, same investments, the tax cost stops them because now money's got to come out of their salary, not only for the funding of the Roth TSP, but for higher taxes as well. So somebody just a normal pre-retiree, if you will, with a federal and state tax bracket would have to pay another $7,500 in tax to max out to 22.5. So they're really looking at $30,000 coming out of their pocket to go in there. And so they go, whoa, I think I like the traditional one.
I think in my next life, I'm going to come back and be very rich and get a Roth for my kids. You know, while they're young, and let it add up, and then 30, 40 years down the road, when they cash in, no taxes.
That's right, and they'll be thanking you for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
you'll never be forgotten
if that happens.
Not initially.
Yeah.
You know what else is interesting? I love numbers, as you know. I like to look at these statistics. And of the retirees, the people who retired from the government, the employee annuitants, there's 1,295 people who are over age 100. Currently receiving retirement benefits. And that's not as many as the survivor beneficiaries, like the spouses who outlived the federal annuitant. In that case, there's almost 1,999 survivor annuitants who are over age 100. And figure this one out, two children who are the children of deceased employees or retirees who are over age 100 still receiving children benefits.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Now, they would be what you'd call dependent children.
Yeah, they're probably handicapped children, but they were handicapped, but they still lived to be 100.
Absolutely, yeah.
And thank goodness for that provision, huh?
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
So if you want to get your money's worth, just live a long time.
Boy, the fountain of statistics.
I like that. Yeah. Well, every year OPM does publish a wealth of these numbers that are very interesting to see.
Now, is that available to just people like you?
Yeah, you have to request it from OPM. They don't put it on their website, but yeah, I guess anybody who has an interest in this could request it from OPM. Just email retire@opm.gov and tell them you'd like the statistical report.
Yeah, you always, when it comes out, you'll do an article or you'll say, Bob, did you know about this? And of course I didn't.
Well, there's about 200 articles in the data you have there.
Yeah. You could write about this for the next year.
All righty. Talking about stats, we have 2 minutes left. Andrew's given us the high sign, so bringing it down to its proper landing. Mike?
Be happy, don't worry. Sequestration is out there, but it may not happen. Remember, people have been worrying about the high five replacing the high three for 20 years. It hasn't happened. Most of these things, there's nothing you can do about it. It's not a date certain. You can retire to avoid it. There's really nothing you can do. So, kind of relax.
All right. Relax and be happy. Mm-hmm. Tammy?
Well, the most popular state for retirees is not Florida. It's California and Texas, but that's probably because those are large states and there's a lot of federal employees that work in both states.
California, they don't give any kind of tax benefit.
No taxes in California.
There's 213,000 retirees living in the state of California. There's only 165,000 in Florida.
Is that where they got that song, Hotel California? You can check out, but you can never leave. Anyway, it's about time for us to leave. Thanks for listening. And as we get closer with tax, I'll probably have more comments. Thanks. And we'll be back next week with a financial planner and friend of Tammy's. Bye-bye. Thanks.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.